Well, we're getting towards the end of the book of Genesis. We have one more patriarch, one more set of stories to look at. And this is another famous set of stories that you've heard since you were children. And this is the story of Joseph. The story of Joseph goes from Genesis 37 through the end of the chapter, or the end of the book, chapter 50. And so we're going to divide it in half. And so today we'll see the first part of the story of Joseph, and then we'll pick up from there for next week. Okay? Now we have the last few weeks, we've talked about, for a number of weeks, Abraham and then Isaac and then last week Jacob. And so now we move on to the next generation. The next generation we see in Genesis 35, starting at verse 22, we see what that next generation consists of. And that is that Jacob had 12 sons. The sons of Leah were Reuben, the firstborn of Jacob, Simeon, Levi, Judah. Okay, and then there's a break. There's some other sons in between there. But then you have Issachar and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel, which were the last two sons that Jacob had, are Joseph and Benjamin. And they're the sons of Rachel's maidservant Bilhah were Dan and Naphtali. And then the sons of Leah's maidservant Zilpah were Gad and Asher. Now those are the sons of Jacob. And so this is the next generation. There's also one other member of that generation, and that was Dinah, one daughter. Now these 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. And we'll be seeing that. These names will continue to pop up as we continue to go through the Old Testament. You'll see the names of these sons as the tribal names. Now why so many sons? There's a dozen of them. Why so many? Well, if you remember our story that we looked at back last week, Genesis 29 and 30, we won't read those verses, but there's a little competition between the sisters. Jacob had two wives, Leah and Rachel, and there was a little competition between them on having kids, so much so that they even got their maids involved in having kids as well. So that's why we've got so many sons. Now, Jacob himself was a favorite son of his mother, where his father had a favorite son, which was his brother Esau. Surely, being on the good side of being a favorite of his mom, but the bad side of being the not favorite of his dad, he would have learned from that, right? So he wouldn't have had any favorite sons, right? Well, let's start our story with Joseph. Genesis 37, verse 3. Now, Israel, now if you remember, Jacob's name was changed to Israel, which means he struggles with God. And so you'll see the name Jacob and Israel interchanged through here. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made a richly ornamented robe for him. So here, the son who got caught up in some of this favoritism didn't learn from that. In fact, he copied that, and he had a favorite son, and he let everybody know about it. He put this special robe on Joseph, and everywhere Joseph went, there was this robe standing out that said, "Hey, everybody, look at me. I'm my dad's favorite son." Okay. Now it says that he was his favorite because he was born to him in his old age. I think there's really a more likely reason, or another reason that I think is equally as important. If you look back at Genesis 29:30, first part of that, you see that Jacob had two wives, Leah and Rachel, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. And so Joseph was the first son to his favorite wife, the wife he really wanted to have, Rachel. And so he cared very greatly for Joseph. Well, how did Joseph's brothers feel about Joseph? Okay, and why? Going on, verse 4. When his brothers saw that his father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. So, how did they feel? They didn't like him. They didn't like that he was the favorite son. It wasn't anything that Joseph had done. Rather, it was just their jealousy over the love that their father had for Joseph more than he had for them. Well, did Joseph do nothing? Well, Joseph did a few things that kind of egged it on. Verse 2, we see that Joseph, when he was 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah. Okay, those would be Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And he brought their father a bad report about them. So he was a tattletale. He passed on to his dad some information about them that they didn't want passed on. So that at least got those four brothers upset with him. But then he also did things that upset all the brothers. Verse 5, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. Okay, we all have dreams. Why would they hate Joseph so much just because of this dream? Well, it's because of what the dream was about. Verses 6 to 7, he said to him, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered all around mine and bowed down to it." Okay. So why did that matter? It's just this grain, this weird, dreams are kind of strange, this strange kind of dream of these brothers' sheaves bowing down to Joseph's sheaf. Why was that something that they would hate him for? Verse 8, his brother said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule over us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. So it was pretty clear to them what that dream meant and what he was saying through that dream. Okay, so they obviously hated him for it. They scolded him for that dream. So from that point on, whenever he dreamed, he didn't tell anybody else about it, right? Well, verse 9, then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. Come on, Joseph, learn here. Okay, he said, "Listen, I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." Okay, so sounds like the same sort of thing, doesn't it? And it is. It's a same basic dream, just a different perspective. Whenever it was thought in those days that whenever you had double dreams that had meaning behind them, that was a guarantee that they would be fulfilled. It guaranteed the certainty that they'd be fulfilled. Well, Jacob, obviously, he's got to take care of the peace in the family, and all these brothers are now hating and really hating this one brother, Joseph, his favorite son. Does he stand up for Joseph and in front of his brothers? Starting at verse 10. "Well, when Joseph told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, 'Hey, what's this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?' His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind." Well, it got a little personal this time, because now he was saying not only would the brothers bow down to him, but also dad. It made the brothers hate him even more. They were jealous of him. Jacob's got to be careful here with this hatred running in the family and the problems there. So does Jacob try to keep Joseph away from his jealous brothers? Going on. "Well, now Joseph's brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem." Okay, and Israel said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them." "Very well," he replied. So he said, "Go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and then bring word back to me." And then he sent them off from the valley of Hebron. So you see that Jacob didn't think much of it, and he wasn't concerned. He sent Joseph to be with his brothers. Now, why wasn't Joseph out watching the flocks? Well, because he was the favorite son, and he didn't have to go do all that work. And so he kind of stayed home around his dad. But his dad sent him off to just check up on him and bring back word. So he's kind of serving as a messenger for his dad here. Well, where did Joseph go to find his brothers? Well, he went to Shechem, right? Going on. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the field and said, "What are you looking for?" He said, "I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they're grazing their flocks?" "Oh, they've moved on from here," the man answered. "I heard him say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. So he would have traveled going from Hebron to Shechem is 60 miles, and then to Dothan is another 15 miles on foot. That's a lot of time. You figure about 3 miles an hour. So you've got a few days of travel here that he's walking, trying to find his brothers. Well, he finally catches up to his brothers up at Dothan, which is just further away. And his brothers see him coming. What do they think? But they saw him in a distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. "Come, now let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what became of his dreams." Okay, so they see him ahead. They see him coming, and you can imagine while they're out in the field just twiddling their thumbs watching the sheep, they're talking about this stupid brother they've got and his stupid dreams and how dad likes him more than anybody and just adding to their furor. And then they see him and they go, okay, here's our chance. Let's get rid of him. We'll see what happens to his dreams. We'll make sure that those dreams don't come to fruition. Okay? Well, someone comes to Joseph's rescue. We see in verse 21, when Reuben heard of this, Reuben is the oldest brother, right? He tried to rescue him from their hands. Don't take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood. Look, just throw him in the cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him. Now, Reuben said this to be able to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. Okay? So Reuben was the oldest brother. He was responsible to dad. And he didn't want to see his brother, as much as he hated Joseph as well, he didn't want to see him killed. He was going to protect him. But he came up with this idea that allowed the brothers to think that they would get rid of him, but they wouldn't have to kill him. So had Reuben always been so discerning and protective of his father's interests? No. Chapter 35, verse 22, this is a verse we kind of skipped over last week, but it'll come up to play next week. Verse 22 says, "While Israel was living in that region, Reuben went in and slept with his father's concubine Bilhah, and Israel heard about it." Who was Bilhah? Bilhah was Rachel's maid, the mother of two of Reuben's brothers. So here he went and slept with his stepmother. Okay. So this comes to haunt him later. You see that in Genesis 49 when Jacob is giving his blessing to the sons. The blessing, the very first blessing, goes to the oldest son. It's to Reuben. And he says in verse 3, "Reuben, you're my firstborn, my might, the first sign of my strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power. But turbulent as the waters, you will no longer excel. For you went up onto your father's bed, onto my couch, and defiled it." Okay? So here, when Jacob's about to die and he's giving his blessings to his sons, he raises that as an issue. Okay. So, but Reuben has stood up for protecting Joseph and just throw him in this cistern, into this pit here. So what do the brothers decide to do? "So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented robe that he was wearing," just put in your face kind of robe, "and they took him and threw him into the cistern." Now the cistern was empty. There was no water in it, so he didn't drown. So they accepted that. They accepted that idea of Reuben. They took away his robe, which was also denoted a position of privilege. And so they took that from him and they threw him into the pit. So their plan was just to leave him there and let him die on his own. Reuben's plan was to come back and rescue him himself. So how did both of those plans change? Verse 25, "Well, as they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead." Now, Ishmaelites were the descendants of Ishmael, the son of the first son of Abraham, and they were coming from Gilead, which is the land to the east of the Jordan River. "The camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, 'Hey, what will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come on, let's sell him to these Ishmaelites and not lay a hand on him. After all, he's our brother, our own flesh and blood.' So his brothers agreed." So Judah kind of was looking, well, I don't know that it's really cool to let him die, why don't we at least let them live and let them go off and just sell them off as a slave here to these Ishmaelites? And they said, okay, that sounds like a good idea. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. Okay? So he was sold for 20 shekels of silver, which is about 8 ounces, not even worth $300. Okay? In Leviticus 27, verse 5, you can see that that is the going rate. If someone was devoted and dedicated to God, that person could be redeemed for a price. And the prices are given there in Leviticus 27. For a person of Joseph's age, it was 20 shekels. So you see that. But what's also interesting is in Matthew 26:15, we see that Jesus was sold for pieces of silver. Okay, well, this was Judah's idea. What about Reuben? Did he think this was a good idea? It says the brothers agreed with that. Well, let's go on. Verse 29. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't here. Where can I turn now?" So he obviously wasn't there when they were selling him to the Ishmaelites. And so when he goes back to the cistern to rescue Joseph, Joseph's not there. Now he's really concerned. So he says, what do we do now? Well, and how do we explain this to Dad? Reuben is the responsible one here. So, verse 31, they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in blood. They took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe." Okay, so they made up this story that he had been eaten by, like they said earlier, a ferocious animal. They put some blood all over it, probably beat it up a bit, and took it to Dad and said, "Dad, I think this looks like Joseph's robe. Take a look, is it?" How did Jacob respond to this loss? He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animals devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and mourned for his son many days. All of his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "in mourning I will go down to the grave to my son." So his father wept for him. This was his favorite son. This is the firstborn son of the wife that he really wanted, not all these other wives that he had. This is the son he loved more than anything. And now his son is dead. And he won't accept comforting and said that he's going to mourn for his son all the rest of his life. In your Bible, you next have in chapter 38 kind of a sideline story. On account of time, we won't look at that story. I'd recommend that maybe you look at that. You'll see some problems with discernment of Judah. Judah is the one who spoke up. Judah is the fourth son. Judah is also happens to be the child of the covenant, who the covenant passes through him to his descendants, and then all the way down the line to David and then to Jesus. But you can see that he had some discernment problems in chapter 38. And in fact, in chapter 38, the descendants of Judah that carry the covenant come through his daughter-in-law Tamar. So you've got a storied and strange past for Jesus' ancestry here. Okay, but going on 39. Okay, back to our story of Joseph. Where was Joseph taken? Well, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. Okay, so he's in Egypt. We see the same thing in verse 36 of chapter 37. Sold to the captain of the guard, of Pharaoh's guard, so a high-ranking official. How did God remember Joseph in Egypt? Well, Yahweh was with Joseph, and he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that Yahweh was with him, and that Yahweh gave him success in everything he did, then Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, Yahweh blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of Yahweh was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So he left in Joseph's care everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he didn't concern himself with anything except for the food that he ate. So you see that God is with Joseph. God blesses Joseph and blesses everything Joseph touches, gives him the King Midas touch here. Everything he does in Potiphar's household comes with success. And so he rises up, and Potiphar recognizes that and puts him in charge of everything. Okay, these verses here state five times that Joseph's successes were caused by God. Okay, that God did that. Now, it did say in this last verse that Potiphar didn't concern himself with anything except for the food that he ate. Okay, why did he have to concern himself with the food that he ate? If we just go a little bit further to Genesis 43, verse 32, this is later in the story that we'll look at next week. It says, they served him by himself, the brothers by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because Egyptians could not eat with Hebrews, for that's detestable to Egyptians. Okay? So, although Joseph was blessed by God, and Potiphar was blessed by his relationship with Joseph, and by having Joseph work for him, Joseph was unclean in his eyes, and Joseph could not be associated with his food and meal. So what threatened Joseph's position, and how did he respond? Going on. Well, Joseph was a well-built and handsome man, and after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he entrusts to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? Here in the house, Potiphar's wife took a liking to Joseph and tried to seduce him, but he rejected it. And he stood against it, even though he was standing against Potiphar's wife, but he didn't want to sin against Potiphar. But more importantly, that last verse, he saw that as a sin against God. Okay, when we do wrong to others, that is a sin against God. And Joseph recognized that and refused to do so. Okay, how did Potiphar's wife respond to Joseph's rejection? And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. One day he went to the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. Okay, so she continued to pursue him and to pressure him and tried to force him, but he remained faithful to God, and he remained faithful to his master Potiphar and refused to. So you see, he stayed away. It says he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her, even be around her. He stayed away from the temptation, stayed away from that threat. Okay. How did she deal with his continued rejection? When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. Look, she said to him, this Hebrew's been brought here to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story. That Hebrew slave that you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. Okay? So she made up this story. And the fact that he had left his robes, his coats, continue to create problems here, don't they? Well, he left it there, and so she used that as part of her story to say that he tried to rape her and accused him of that to her husband when her husband came home. Well, how did Potiphar respond to this accusation against his very successful chief servant? When the master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, this is how your slave treated me, he burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. Okay? Now, he was angry. He was very mad. But you can also see he was a little uncertain about this whole thing. He probably suspected his wife and wasn't sure whether it was his fault or her fault. And so he throws Joseph in prison. That's the only thing he really could do. But you see, he puts him in the king's prison. Now, Potiphar is the captain of the guard, so this would be a prison that would be underneath his responsibility as well as other prisons. But this is a light punishment kind of prison. This is for taking good care of some certain prisoners that the king puts in. So we saw that God had remembered and now seemingly forgot Joseph in Potiphar's house. How did God remember him in prison? Going on. Well, while Joseph was there in prison, Yahweh was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because Yahweh was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. So just as Joseph saw great success in whatever he did in Potiphar's household and acting as a servant and then leadership as a servant in Potiphar's household, he saw the same success in prison. And God blessed him there. God blessed everything he touched. And so he was given a lot of responsibility and privileges in prison while he was there. Okay? Some time passes. We don't know the exact dates of all this yet, but sometime later, chapter 40, it says that the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their master, the king of Egypt. Now Pharaoh was angry with these two officials and put them in custody of the house of the captain of the guard, who is Potiphar, right? In the same prison where Joseph was confined. Okay? So something happened. We don't know what, but something happened that made Pharaoh upset with the chief baker and the chief cupbearer. Now, he had to have great trust in these people. They were responsible for Pharaoh living. Poisoning was often a way that people would use to try to get rid of an enemy. And so a cupbearer would be someone you would trust to make sure that whatever you drank was safe. Cupbearer would take a sip and make sure that he didn't die first, kind of thing. The baker, same sort of thing with food. So these had to be trustworthy people. So something happened to where Pharaoh didn't trust them as much as he felt that he should, and he threw them in prison. And it happened to be the same prison, same place where Joseph was confined. Okay? But these were highly ranked and highly trusted men. So how did God intervene so that Joseph would then interact with these high-profile men? Well, the captain of the guard assigned them to Joseph, and he attended them. After they'd been in custody for some time, each of the two men, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were being held in prison, they had a dream the same night, and each dream had a meaning of its own. Okay? So God put things in place to where these men came under the custody, under the responsibility of Joseph, and then they had these dreams, and Joseph's dealt with dreams before, right? Okay. So, but what did these dreams that these guys have, what do they have to do with Joseph? Going on, when Joseph came to them the next morning, he saw that they were dejected. So he asked Pharaoh's officials who were in custody with him in his master's house, "Why are your faces so sad today?" "We both had dreams," they answered, "but there's no one to interpret them." Well, Joseph said to them, "Don't interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams." Okay? So he recognized that, okay, no matter how complicated your dreams are, God can interpret them. God can explain those. And here you see he recognizes his relationship with God. He says, "Tell me your dreams. We'll see if God tells me what to tell you the dreams mean." Okay? Does God use dreams elsewhere? Yeah, we see them various places. Some of the visions that we've seen, like visions that Abraham had and where God came and spoke to him, we've seen that. We see some similar things in Daniel as far as interpreting dreams. In Daniel chapter 2, there's a dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. And in fact, this is a dream where he goes and he says, I not only want to know what the meaning of my dream is, but to make sure that you know, that you can, that I know that you're telling me what this dream really means, I'm not going to tell you the dream. You tell me what the dream is too. Okay. Daniel responds, he says, no wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery that he's asked about, but there's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that pass through your mind as you lay on your bed are these. And he goes on and tells him the dreams and tells him what those dreams mean. And then in verse 47, Nebuchadnezzar says to Daniel, surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you are able to reveal this mystery. Okay? So God uses dreams and uses his people to interpret dreams to accomplish his will. We see that in a few cases here. All right, well, let's look at these dreams of the cupbearer and the baker. First, the cupbearer. What was his dream and what did it mean? So the chief cupbearer told Joseph his dream. He said to him, in my dream, I saw a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. As soon as it budded, it blossomed, and then its clusters ripened into grapes. So really fast motion video here. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and put the cup in his hand. Oh, this is what it means, Joseph said to him. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your position. And you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand just as you used to when you were his cupbearer. Okay? So, you see the dream, you see the interpretation. Joseph says, in 3 days you're going to be released. That's what lift up your head means. In fact, that's kind of a slang phrase that's used for that. You'll see that in other places. But you'll be released, you'll be restored to your position, and everything will be back to good as it was before. All right? What was this? Was there a reason why this cupbearer might have this dream? Well, Joseph saw it. Next verses, he says, but when all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. For I was forcibly carried from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I've done nothing to deserve being put in a dungeon. Okay? So he sees that the cupbearer being released is possibly his ticket out of here. And so he asks the cupbearer to remember me, and when this happens, as I've told you, mention it to Pharaoh. Let him know about me here. Okay? Now the word here that's used for dungeon says, get me out of this dungeon, I've done nothing to deserve being put in a dungeon. That's the exact same Hebrew word that was used back earlier for cistern, where the brothers threw him into a cistern. So it's the exact same Hebrew word used in both cases. All right? So that's the cupbearer's dream and the purpose of that, at least Joseph seeing it. Well, the baker's sitting there thinking, oh, okay, that's pretty good. Maybe mine means the same thing. So what was the baker's dream and what was its meaning? When the chief baker saw that Joseph had given a favorable interpretation, he said to Joseph, ah, I too had a dream. On my head were three baskets of bread. So I get the three thing again. In the top basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh. But the birds were eating them out of the basket in my head. Ah, this is what it means, Joseph said. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat away your flesh. Ooh, not as good of an interpretation, not as good of a dream as what the cupbearer had. And you see a little play on words here. Instead of he will lift up your head or release you, he will lift off your head and kill you and execute you. Okay, so after 3 days, the baker would be hanged. Well, were Joseph's interpretations correct? Well, the third day was Pharaoh's birthday, verse 20, and he gave a feast for all of his officials. He lifted up the heads of the chief cupbearer and the chief baker in the presence of his officials. He restored the chief cupbearer to his position so that he once again put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, just as Joseph had said. But he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had said to them in his interpretation. So everything was just as Joseph had said. And did the cupbearer fulfill the purpose of his dream that Joseph saw in terms of saying something to Pharaoh and working for Joseph's release? Verse 23, the chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. Okay? So no, he forgot him. So Joseph stayed in prison longer. How much longer? Chapter 41, when 2 full years had passed. Okay, so he was there for 2 more full years. He was there until the time was right. The time was not yet right. Now that has a lot to say about our timing versus God's timing. Has a lot to say for Joseph's patience while he's there sitting in prison. Has no idea what the future holds. It could be the rest of his life in prison. He doesn't know. Okay? But his patience can be an example for us. James, in his letter starting in chapter 5, verse 7, says, be patient then, brothers, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, and how patient he is for the autumn and spring rains. Or you too be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. Brothers, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we consider blessed those who have persevered. You've heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. Okay? So we're called, like Joseph, to be patient and to wait for what God's promised. And so we have Joseph patiently sitting in prison. Well, we see then that Pharaoh has a dream. What is that dream? Well, he was standing by the Nile when out of the river there came up 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, 7 other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up out of the Nile and stood beside those on the riverbank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the 7 sleek, fat cows. Then Pharaoh awoke. Okay? So, dreams can be weird. So we have this weird dream of these 7 fat cows coming up out of the river. I guess where they were cooling themselves or who knows what in a dream. And then 7 other ugly, skinny cows come up and eat the fat cows so that the fat cows are no more. Alright? It's kind of a weird dream. He wakes up. What happens when he tries to go back to sleep? Well, he fell asleep again and had a second dream. 7 heads of grain, healthy and good, were growing on a single stalk. After them, 7 other heads of grain sprouted, thin and scorched by the east wind. Now, the east wind comes in from the east, which there's desert to the east of Egypt. So an east wind would be hot and dry. Okay, so they were thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the 7 healthy, full heads. Then Pharaoh woke up. It had been a dream. Okay? So he had these 2 dreams. They sound pretty similar, but they're a little different. 7 full grain heads being eaten by 7 thin and scrawny grain heads. Okay? So 2 very similar dreams. But he doesn't know what they mean. So Pharaoh, he's got people who can help him with this. So verse 8, in the morning his mind was troubled, so he sent for all the magicians and wise men of Egypt. Pharaoh told them his dreams, but no one could interpret them for him. Okay? So no one could figure out what those weird dreams meant. Well, someone had amnesia who was finally cured of the amnesia. Okay, verse 9. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, oh, today I'm reminded of my shortcomings. Pharaoh was once angry with the servants, and he imprisoned me and the chief baker in the house of the captain of the guard. Each of us had a dream that same night, and each dream had a meaning of its own. Now, a young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. We told him our dreams, and he interpreted them for us, giving each man the interpretation of his dream. And things turned out exactly as he interpreted them to us. I was restored to my position, and the other man was hanged. Okay, so the chief cupbearer, 2 years later, finally remembers Joseph. finally says something to Pharaoh about Joseph. But look at this. This is the right time. This is the best time. If he'd have said something else to Pharaoh earlier, Pharaoh wouldn't have cared, would have just blown him off. But now it matters to Pharaoh. So what does Pharaoh do? Will Joseph actually be able to interpret these weird dreams when no one else could? Going on. So Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was quickly brought from the dungeon. When he had shaved and changed his clothes and became presentable to Pharaoh, he came before Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I had a dream, and no one can interpret it. But I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." "I cannot do it," Joseph said to Pharaoh. "But God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires." So you see again, when he gets the opportunity to interpret a dream, he doesn't claim that he can do this. He claims only God can interpret dreams, and that God will interpret dreams. So "I cannot do it, but God will give Pharaoh the answer," he says. Okay. We see this this same sort of thing paralleled again in Egypt in Exodus chapter 7. Verses 10 to 12, we see, "So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did just as the Lord had commanded. Aaron threw his staff down in front of Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a snake. Pharaoh then summoned wise men and sorcerers, and the Egyptian magicians also did the same thing by their secret art." So you see that the magicians could do it. So both of them could do it. "Each one threw down a staff, and it became a snake. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Yet still, Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said." Okay, so you do have a superiority there, where Aaron's rod is more powerful than all the rods or all the snakes of the magicians. And there's a message of that we see in chapter 8. It says they did this, and this is the thing of the gnats. They did this when Aaron stretched out his hand with the staff and struck the dust of the ground. Gnats came upon men and animals. All the dust throughout the land of Egypt became gnats. But when the magicians tried to produce gnats by their secret arts, they could not, and the gnats were on men and animals. The magician said to Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God." But Pharaoh's heart was hard, and he would not listen, just as the Lord had said. So the point of this: why were all the magicians and sorcerers and astrologers and whatever and wise men in Pharaoh's employ not able to interpret the dreams, but Joseph would be able to? Because it's not Joseph either, it's God. Only God could interpret these dreams. God's power is greater than that of man's power or Satan's power. Okay? All right. Well, time has passed, and as time passes, your dreams kind of go away, and you kind of forget some of the details. You forget about the dreams. Does Pharaoh remember his dreams well enough to tell them to Joseph? Verse 17. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "In my dream, I was standing on the bank of the Nile, when out of the river there came seven cows, fat and sleek, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, seven other cows came up, scrawny and very ugly and lean. I had never seen such ugly cows in all the land of Egypt. The lean, ugly cows ate up the seven fat cows that came up first. But even after they ate them, no one could tell they had done so. They looked just as ugly as before. Well, then I woke up. And in my dreams, I saw seven heads of grain, full and good, growing on a single stalk. After them, seven other heads sprouted, withered and thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the seven good heads. I told this to the magicians, but none could explain it to me." Okay, so he remembers his dreams just very well. Would it have been a problem if Pharaoh had forgotten what his dreams were? No, if you look back at that Daniel verse, Daniel 2, you see that that was exactly what, Nebuchadnezzar had not forgotten his dreams, but he wanted the wise men to not only tell him the meaning of the dreams, but the dream itself. And Daniel was able to do that. So you can look at that chapter yourself. So what were the meaning of these dreams that that Pharaoh had? Okay, they sound similar, but they're different. But they're weird too. Okay, starting at verse 25. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, The dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he's about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads of grain are 7 years. It's one and the same dream. The seven lean, ugly cows that came up afterward are 7 years, and so are the seven worthless heads of grain scorched by the east wind. They're 7 years of famine. So it's just as I said to Pharaoh, God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. 7 years of great abundance are coming through the land of Egypt, but 7 years of famine will follow them. Then all the abundance in Egypt will be forgotten, and the famine will ravage the land. The abundance in the land will not be remembered because the famine that follows it will be so severe. The reason the dream was given to Pharaoh in two forms is that the matter has been firmly decided by God, and God will do it soon. Okay? So Joseph very clearly spells out what these dreams mean. Okay? There's going to be 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of extreme famine. And God's telling you this, Pharaoh, so that you can make some preparations. Now again, the verse 32 there, the point of this is there's two dreams saying the same thing, and again, that double statement of dreams just shows the certainty that it is the case, that these dreams are telling the truth. Okay? All right, so what, given this, what does Joseph recommend to Pharaoh? Going on. Joseph says, "And now, let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land to take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. They should collect all the food of these good years that are coming and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh to be kept in the cities for food. This food should be held in reserve for the country to be used during the 7 years of famine that will come upon Egypt so that the country may not be ruined by the famine." So he has this idea to appoint someone to this new task of taking 20% of all the grain for the next 7 years so that there will be some grain for the following 7 years when there will be this great famine. Okay? So save during plenty for use during the time of famine. Well, who would Pharaoh find for a task like this and why? Well, the plan seems so good to Pharaoh and all his officials. So, Pharaoh asked them, "Can we find anyone like this man, one whom in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." Okay? So who did he find? He found Joseph. Why? Because God clearly was with Joseph. God had given Joseph the ability to interpret these dreams very clearly, and even what he should do about these dreams, even though all his wise men and officials couldn't. So who better than someone who God is with? So how much power did Pharaoh give Joseph? Well, I just read the verse 40, that says that he was only second in command only to Joseph, only to Pharaoh. So Pharaoh said to Joseph in verse 41, "I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt." Okay, so gives him great power. How does Pharaoh make sure that everyone knows the responsibility and power that this jailbird, Hebrew slave, whatever, now has? Going on, then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. Now, signet ring, this is what you would you'd put your seal on a wax or clay seal that said, "This is me." And so here, that conveys the authority, and that brings the authority of Pharaoh. And he puts that ring on Joseph's finger, giving him that authority. He dressed him in robes of fine linen, put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in a chariot as his second in command, and men shouted before him, "Make way!" Thus he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Okay, so he dressed him royally, gave him his power, and paraded him around so that everybody would see Joseph and know that Joseph had this power and responsibility. Okay? So how old was Joseph at this time? You know, the last time we saw a date was he was 17 years old when he, in chapter 37, when he brought the bad report on his brothers. So how much time had passed until this? Verse 44. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I'm Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift hand or foot in all of Egypt." Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zaphnath-Paneah and gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, to be his wife. And Joseph went throughout the land of Egypt. He was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from Pharaoh's presence and traveled throughout Egypt. Okay, so he was only 30 years old, and yet now he's second in command of all Egypt, the greatest power in the world. Okay, and you see, he dives right into his job. He's given an official Egyptian name, this Zaphnath-Paneah, and given an Egyptian wife, but not just any Egyptian wife. This is the daughter of a priest of Ra from the city of On. So you see, he's becoming very Egyptian here, and very high ranking and respected. All right, he has some kids, and what does he name his children? Verse 50. Before the years of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph by Asenath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh. Okay, Manasseh sounds like and may be derived from the Hebrew word for forget. Okay, named him Manasseh and said, "It's because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household." While the second son he named Ephraim, and said, "It's because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering." Ephraim means fruitful, or twice fruitful. So he named his sons Forget, because God had allowed him to forget all of his horrible past, and twice fruitful, because he's had two sons. All right, what about his job? What did he do during the 7 years of abundance? Well, let's back up here. Verse 47. During the 7 years of abundance, the land produced plentifully. Joseph collected all the food produced in those 7 years of abundance in Egypt and stored it in the cities. In each city, he put the food grown in the fields surrounding it. Joseph stored up huge quantities of grain, like the sand of the sea. It was so much that he stopped keeping records because it was beyond measure. Okay? So he collected all the grain, just as he told Pharaoh to do. 20%, and it just piled up and piled up and piled up. He had trouble finding places to put it. It was too much trouble to even measure and count, so it just piled up. But he knew he had to keep collecting because 7 years of famine were following. And what did he do then? Verse 53, the 7 years of abundance in Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the other lands, but in the whole land of Egypt, there was food because of what Joseph had done. And he didn't just put that food in one spot. He put that, as we saw before, in the cities so that people didn't have to all come to one place. It was located in the cities. When all of Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food. Well, then Pharaoh told the Egyptians, "Go to Joseph and do what he tells you." When the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt. When the famine started, after a period of time, people no longer had grain that they had stored up for themselves, no longer had their own food, and they started crying to Pharaoh, and then that's when Joseph opened up the storehouses. And he didn't give it to them, you see, he sold it. We'll talk more about that next week. He sold it to them. And we also see that the famine wasn't just in Egypt. The famine was all over. And so people in other countries were experiencing famines, and there was no food anywhere else. You didn't have the gathering of food in other countries like you had here. So people, God used that to help Joseph bless all the nations of the world. We see in verse 57, all the countries came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the world. through this, and we'll see this next week, Joseph, his actions are making Egypt very wealthy. Not only wealthy from the people of Egypt paying money for this grain that he had collected, but also people from all other countries coming and paying whatever to get grain, to get food, to be able to live. Okay? And we'll pick up from there next week, and we'll see how Joseph then meets his brothers and his father and the rest of the story of Joseph. Okay? Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the story of Joseph. It's a story that's good for us to keep in mind, because so many times we go through difficult times and we don't know if there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Joseph went through some very difficult times. He was to be killed by his brothers, but then sold as a slave. He was wrongly accused as a, even though he was a great servant and a great leader for his master, wrongly accused and then ended up in prison. In prison, he did great, and he did great for the warden, but yet he was forgotten by the cupbearer and had no future, apparently. But through all of this, God was preparing him so that when, in the fullness of time, in the fullness of God's time, Joseph was prepared to the task that he had for him. And we thank you for that story, because it shows us that you can take the horrible things that happen in our lives and you can turn them around to your good. You can use those to prepare us. You can use those to guide us. You can use those to accomplish your good, even though we bring a lot of that evil on ourselves through our sinful actions and our sinful lives. Thank you for those lessons. Be with us. Show us. Continue to show us that you're in control of all things and of our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.